I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week we're talking about the HBO series Sharp Objects and the Netflix original animated series Disenchantment.
We've also watched the 2010 film Beginners for the first time, thanks to a listener recommendation, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to Seriously. I've got a little thing in my throat. Have you? I feel like I've got something going on back here. So I'm sorry if I sound weird.
Oh, yeah. Listeners. I'm still getting over my cold from the previous episode 2 weeks ago. So yeah, if we're croaking at you, we're sorry.
Sickly women, sickly ladies. I have just got back from a week-long holiday in Sicily, so I should be all like rejuvenated and, you know, I don't know, brown and sweet, but I just feel a little bit like coming back to autumn, which was a shock, has kind of drained me a little bit. But autumn is great for culture lovers, isn't it? Because there's always so much good new TV and film to be seen. Or it's kind of terrible for culture lovers, depending on which way you look at it, because who has time to keep going out to, you know, the cinema and keep downloading new TV shows?
That's true. But I am very excited, for instance, that Killing Eve has finally got a UK air date.
Oh my god, yes, we're gonna talk about that so hard.
I know. And also stuff like, you know, traditional American network shows always come back in the autumn. I've mentioned this before, but I'm really excited for the next series of The Good Place, which I think is starting end of September. Like, lots of that kind of fall stuff is coming.
Yeah, I don't actually know when the new Jane the Virgin series is coming, but I think that actually might be delayed a bit longer. Yeah, I'm hyped. I also saw my first like big picture of the next kind of year cycle. I saw a screening of First Man,
the new Damien Chazelle film,
the other day. Yeah, with Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong. So that's when I'm like, oh yeah, we're getting back into watching movies. Though I imagine that will probably have like a February 2019 release date in the UK or something ridiculous, as they all do. But
yes, yeah, well, I've been enjoying, a friend of the show, Simran Hans, has been at the Toronto International Film Festival, I think, for her main job as a film critic at The Observer. And so I've been enjoying seeing her like tweeting and Instagramming about like all of the big, serious, important movies that we are all going to have to pay attention to in the next awards cycle and stuff.
Yeah, and it was Venice the week before, which I think, well, someone's going to tell me I'm wrong now, but I think that was the first La La Land screening a couple of years ago or whatever. So often, like,
yes, I think you're right, yeah,
the best picture almost winner in that case, you know, or things like that start to trickle down. But yeah, not for us mere mortals.
Yes, absolutely, and especially us mere mortals in the UK.
Anyway, we're just like rambling about nothing now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Let's get on with it. So what are we going to talk about first this week, Anna?
The first thing that we're going to talk about this week, Caroline, is Sharp Objects, an 8-episode TV adaptation of Gillian Flynn's novel of the same name. It stars Amy Adams as Camille Preaker, a crime reporter in St. Louis in the American Midwest, who's sent back to her hometown of Wingap, Missouri, to report on the disappearance of two girls. In the course of her investigation, she uncovers uncomfortable truths about the town and also her own family. Before we start talking about Sharp Objects, I know that we're rambling too much already this episode, but I have been thinking for the last couple of days, you know how, I think this is always really overblown, but you know how they always say, oh, Charles Dickens was like the EastEnders of his day.
Mm-hmm. If Shakespeare was alive today, he'd be writing for HBO.
Yeah, stuff like that.
The New Statesman actually literally once published an article with that title.
Right. Sorry, this is a really roundabout point. Yours was more succinct, but I have been thinking about Gone Girl a lot mm-hmm. lately, and how I actually think that although Gone Girl was like very much marketed as a commercial thriller, mm-hmm. and obviously was a commercial thriller and was, you know, a bestseller, and it did get really good reviews, it also like didn't get nominated for any big prizes or anything like that because it was a commercial piece of like a commercial thriller. And I also first read Gone Girl and kind of like hated it and had like a really strong, like quite negative reaction to it. But I've started to think that I think maybe Gone Girl might be the, like, in 20 years time, because like Distance always gives you on like crime stuff, it makes it seem a bit more literary, like Agatha Christie, who I know you're a big lover of, is seen as more literary than she possibly was when she was first publishing now. Is that true or not?
I think that's definitely true, yeah. Like, for instance, Agatha Christie wrote, I think it was 6 other novels under a pseudonym because she wanted them to be, they were more like psychological novels, not necessarily right. ones where anyone died. And I think she wanted people to assess them as like just novels in their own right. Possibly with
not
like
Agatha
an
Christie
eye to,
novels.
Exactly, yeah. So I think she did see the like Agatha Christie brand at the time as like, not that they were like potboilers or anything, but just, yeah, they were very much like in the lower end of the market, as it were.
Yeah. So I wonder if like Gone Girl will be like a kind of Patricia Highsmith-y sort of book in 20 years time. Because
I agree. Yeah. And not least because I'd not read Sharp Objects before seeing the thing, but I've now been listening to the audiobook. And there's loads more in the book about the like state of journalism at the time and in the same way that Gone Girl's got a real like recession vibe to it. You know, they both lose their jobs and like move across the country and then live in like a McMansion that was partly abandoned because of the recession and stuff, and how like the sort of this small town has been affected by economic downturn and what it did to masculinity and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, there's loads in there that I think you're right, with more distance people would be like, this was incredibly smart.
Totally. And I just think that character is such a vivid character, Amy in Gone Girl. And she's like so horrific. And there are quotes that I just still think about all the time. Like when she's like, you think you'd be happy with some nice Midwestern American girl? I'd kill for you. You know, like all that stuff. It's just so... Anyway, obviously the point for those who are really confused that I didn't say up front is that Gillian Flynn, the author of the book Sharp Objects, also wrote Gone Girl. So yes. I'm not just talking about Gone Girl for no reason.
I just think it's really interesting as well that Sharp Objects was her first novel. It was her debut novel, which is just amazing to me because I think it's so accomplished. Like now that I'm listening to her actual words as well as having seen how it was adapted for the screen, and like, this is amazing that she wrote this as her first like full-length novel.
So it's been adapted for HBO by Jean-Marc Vallée, the director's name, who did Big Little Lies, which we were huge fans of, loved Big Little Lies. And it's very kind of like moody and atmospheric. So it differs from Gone Girl in that it's not actually a super plot-heavy or at least plot-driven story, or at least in adaptation. It doesn't come across that way. And it's definitely been done as a kind of like atmospheric stylized thing. And it's 8 episodes. And how spoilery are we going to go, Caroline, as we discuss these 8 episodes? Because we've both seen it all.
I think we should go full spoiler, because I think it's difficult to talk about it without accidentally putting one's foot in it.
Yes. I'm so glad, because I completely agree. I really would quite like to get into the meat of the twists and turns of this.
Yeah.
But I guess for those people who are going to tune out of this discussion, in that case, I would say it's worth watching, and it's also worth sticking with if the first couple of episodes don't grab you, because they didn't grab me. And I actually only carried on watching it because my boyfriend really forced me to. And then I found the final 3 or so episodes really thrilling and really, really delight. Like, they're really horrible and they're really depressing in lots of ways, but they're really kind of like delightful to watch at the same time because... I won't say any more than that, but I would recommend it.
I would also say, as a point of information for British listeners, you can watch all of this on Now TV, which you can sign up for a free 14-day trial of and then cancel without paying anything. So if you are someone who sometimes struggles to know where you can watch big American things if you don't have Sky, that is where you can watch this on Now TV.
Great point of information. So, full spoiler review. Yeah, as I said just then, like, I don't know how you felt about it, whether it really did grip you from the beginning, but the premise is that, you know, as we said up top, that Camille, the Amy Adams lead journalist character, who's like kind of a cliche of a like Jessica Jones style, like alcoholic, workaholic, traumatic family or home life person, she goes back to her hometown to solve this crime, and in doing so has to like move in with her mom and like reopen old wounds. And she's kind of like driving around and a little bit drunk and like going to different bars and interviewing people about the disappearance, and very quickly becomes murder of two girls at different times, not the same time, in her hometown. And I found those first few episodes where she's kind of like doing that investigative journalistic work really tropey.
So
really,
much
like really all derivative
the, all the stuff of her like laying out all her little miniature bottles of alcohol on her scummy motel bed and all of that kind of stuff, and like all of the sort of functioning alcoholic coping mechanisms it shows of like her swigging vodka and then swigging mouthwash and stuff like that. Yeah, I was thinking like, why is everyone on social media raving about this? It's really derivative.
Totally. I felt the same, and like I just sort of felt like, what's the point of this story? And before I even watched it, I also came with preconceptions about it, because I, like I said, had quite a negative immediate reaction to Gone Girl, where I felt really cheated by the narrative twist in Gone Girl. And after that twist, the book like completely goes off the rails into these like really absurd directions, which I think are actually quite brilliant, but they are super absurd. And I kind of felt like this was a very artsy, very serious HBO program that I highly suspected at some point was going to completely go off the rails. So I was a bit like, why are you asking me to take this seriously? Because I think something really mental is going to happen. And at that point, I'll be like, well, why wasn't this a bit funnier at least? Why couldn't we have had some more fun?
It's not funny at all.
Which is how I felt about Hereditary, because it does just halfway through go completely bonkers. And I'm like, well, why did this have to be so depressing then? Why couldn't it have been a bit more like a fun horror film? But the weirder it got, the more I actually really loved it. And you're right, it never got funny, but it, for me, moved into more of a crazy horror zone.
Yeah, it does. It goes so dark that you're like, actually, was this frame narrative of her being an investigative journalist actually just minor? Like, this was, I mean, it's necessary to give the impetus for her to return to the town.
Mm-hmm. Or even a red herring.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, maybe it's a way of throwing you off the scent of what's actually happening, because it's so tropey that you're like, oh, well, okay, well, let's suspect the like father figure, or like, let's suspect the sheriff in a classic Agatha Christie style twist. And like, it throws you off the scent quite a lot of like what is actually happening. Although it's not like super dependent on you not suspecting the person who did it. That wouldn't matter if you did, you'd still enjoy it. But I think in a way it's almost like, because you're not, when you watch a horror film, you kind of think things to yourself like, I mean, this isn't the solution to sharp objects, but you think like, maybe it's split personality, or like maybe it's, you jump to those conclusions. Whereas when it's like a more traditional detective thing, you like always suspect the man, and you always suspect, you know, someone in a position of trust to the victim, and like all this kind of stuff. And I loved that it kind of like suddenly just went into like really weird, claustrophobic, psychologically terrifying terrain halfway through.
So just to give you a bit of background about Camille's family, like, her mum is really controlling and psychotic sometimes, and she lives in this like picture perfect colonial mansion, and she's married again, and Camille had a younger sister who died, and she's very still like emotionally repressed about her grief about that. And her mother has like since had another daughter who Camille doesn't even really know at the beginning. Like, she actually meets her loads in the first episode without realizing that it's her. Mm-hmm. And it's only at the end that there's almost like this reveal that like, oh right, that was your sister that you were talking to the whole time. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it really, really retreats into this like family psychological horror in a way that I wasn't expecting at all. But then I actually went back and watched the first episode again after I'd watched the whole thing, because I got really obsessed with this, and I read a lot of like screen grab by screen grab deconstructions of it as well. And
yeah, I went on Tumblr again for the first time in a long time because of this show.
It started to give me real Get Out vibes, actually, the first episode on my rewatch, because I don't know, the first time I watched it, I was like, right, fine. So she's from a like really posh family that she hates.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, that's just part of her kind of tropey backstory, I'm sure, mm-hmm. to like give her a chip on her shoulder. But then when you rewatch it, you're like, oh, this house is evil. And the fact that her mum has this like black woman servant who she doesn't ever make eye contact with, but who's like always in the background of the shots, mm-hmm. and stuff, are like, oh, right. So yeah, they were telling us at the beginning that this house and this woman were bad news, but I wasn't really paying attention because, as you say, the like investigative journalism thing is sort of a red herring.
Totally. And, you know, full spoilers for the final episode ahead. The final twist is, of course, is like, you know, the phone calls coming from within the house. And like, you always expect the personal history of the detective in these situations and their crime to be somehow related, sometimes metaphorically, sometimes literally. Mm-hmm. But in this one, it's literally just like, oh, remember your evil family? Yeah, they did the murders too. And that's the final twist. But I thought it was really cleverly done because the final episode is basically like Camille realizing that the root of all this is that her mother is obsessed with kind of like caring for her children as long as they're vulnerable and in her control.
Munchausen's by proxy is the name for it. And it's also a central plot device in The Bridge.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. That's another
come into the cultural consciousness of a kind of like weird crime solution thing.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to me as like a woman's crime and like a domestic crime that like it's a crime of caring too much.
Yes.
Like, I've yet to see any portrayal of like a man with Munchausen's by proxy. Do they even get it? Like, who knows?
Completely. And for me, I'm really, me and Caroline were talking about this before the show, but I've become really obsessed with Doll's Houses lately. And the Doll's House features very prominently in this, both literally in the solving of the crime and kind of metaphorically as a way to show the like claustrophobia of the household and the desire to control other people like dolls and like be kind of maternalistic towards the doll, but also like be in complete control and how that's like really claustrophobic for the other people in the house. And in the 7th or 8th episode, I think it might be the 7th episode, I can't remember, but in some of the final climactic scenes, the house begins to that level of claustrophobia is so intense in the real house as well as the miniaturized version. You know, the Doll's House has the same wallpaper that's on the walls and the same furniture, and you know, it's an exact replica of this Doll's House, but the real house becomes that intense scary prison as Camille and Amma, her younger sister, are like sucked of the ability to care for themselves by their mum poisoning them. And that's just really scary to me. And it was like suddenly watching a horror sequence. Like there was no way out of it. Really felt like there was no way out of that situation for them. And I was really terrified.
Something else I picked up on my rewatch of the first episode was that when Amma first shows her Camille the dollhouse, Camille's room isn't there. There's like just a gap. There's like, it shows you the hallway in the same shot that you see the actual real hallway of the house and then the door that she goes through into her old bedroom. But in the Doll's House, it's just a gap. There's nothing there, which after what you find out at the end of the 8th episode, you're like, Amma is a psychopath who thinks her sister is worth nothing. Mm. I don't know. It gives you all kind of shivers.
I also wonder if she wasn't allowed in the room because she's really obsessive about trying to get Camille to let her into the room. And her mum doesn't like it when she goes in there. But yeah, I was obsessed with the Doll's House the whole way through. So I kept saying to, because I'm trying to work on a piece about miniature houses separately. So I kept turning to Nick the whole time we were watching it and being like, the Doll's House is the solution to this crime because they keep
showing it to you,
telegraphing that the Doll's House is. And I just felt that it was going to go beyond the metaphorical. And the final connection between the Doll's House and the crime and the real house is just so aesthetically perfect that it sent a full shiver down my spine.
You mean the floor?
Yeah. So basically, obviously, as I don't know why I'm explaining it as though listeners at this point will not already know, but there are two things they keep telegraphing is that Amma is in love with this bloody Doll's House.
Mm-hmm.
She keeps taking it, you know, when they move out of the town, she takes it with her and everything. The unsolved element of the crime is that they never found the missing teeth of the girls who died because all their teeth had been removed and they never found where they went. And another piece of information we have is that their mother is obsessed with her ivory floor.
Yeah.
And somehow all those things are telegraphed quite heavily both visually and in dialogue throughout the whole thing. Mm. And yet it's done subtly enough that you never think the teeth are the ivory floor
of the doll's house. They are the miniature.
You never make that connection in your mind until the very last moment. I think because I was so obsessed with the doll's house, there was a point where right in the final episode, they show the floor again for like the 90th time. And I turned to Nick and I was like, oh my God, the teeth are in the doll's house. The teeth are in the doll's house. And it just gave me a full body shiver. I just found it so pleasurable and so great. And it kind of was fun, even though it wasn't funny in the end, I thought.
It's fun in the sense that a well-constructed mystery is always fun. Like that feeling of like a piece of clockwork clicking into place.
Exactly.
It's a really satisfying feeling, even if it's horrific. The actual, like when you step back for a second, you're like, she was pulling dead girls' teeth out and putting them in her doll's house.
Yes. And they give you a really cliffhangery ending where Camille's moved away from the town. They think that the mum did it. They've taken Amma away. They're living together. She, for some reason, has to, like, you know, find something missing from the doll's house. So goes to put it back and then finds the teeth floor. And Amma turns around and says, don't tell mama. And it's like a cliffhanger. And that makes you feel like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And I get the impression it's more thoroughly gone over in the book. But what they do is give you little clips in the credits sequence where you see Amma committing the murders, but just like tiny little quick,
like 2 second
shots.
Flashes.
Yeah. And the actress is bloody incredible.
Yeah, really she's good, really like, good. She's really scary.
She's terrifying. And the in those a kind last of shining punches way, like, that they kind of like don't pull until the final moment. It just really click everything into place about that character. Mm. And it worked incredibly well for me.
Something I wanted to bring up as well, this idea of the show like telegraphing you stuff. Mm. One thing that it does is it messes with point of view a lot. Mm. So it shows you, and I didn't realize this until about episode 5, that sometimes you're seeing things from Camille's point of view, like a slightly hazy, flickery alcoholic's point of view. And that's why you get a lot of like flickering lights. Mm. A lot of text on the screen says things that you're not expecting. So I didn't spot this for ages. And then I noticed that her car radio, like the words where it would say the name of the station and like the numbers, keep saying things like wrong or no or things like that. And lots of like road signs keep changing and shifting and that kind of thing. And then I went and like Googled this extensively online, and there's a really
hundreds of them in the show.
There's actually hundreds of them in the show. And like, there's a really good post, which I will find and link, where someone's like screen grabbed every single one and like written what they think it means at that moment in the show. Mm. Which if you've watched the whole thing is very, very enjoyable to read. But yeah, and then at other times, you're shown the same scene, but not from Camille's point of view, and the signs all look fine and it's all as you would expect. So there is that sort of, in the same way that Gone Girl is very much predicated on the idea of like the unreliable narrator and things not being all there seemed, the idea that like you're seeing a first person unreliable view of something and then also not is very interesting and a really like clever piece of direction, I think.
Completely. Yeah. So I really, really enjoyed it. And it was kind of my perfect stopover until Big Little Lies season 2, which I'm really excited for.
Yeah, definitely
watch
it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So now we're going to talk about Disenchantment, which is an animated fantasy series created for Netflix by Matt Groening, who also made The Simpsons and Futurama. It follows the adventures of Princess Bean, who is voiced by Broad City's Abby Jacobson, who likes drinking, gambling and getting into trouble as she grapples with the arrival of a personal demon and an impending royal marriage.
Yeah, a literal personal demon.
Yeah, it's very like... you know, in Mulan,
yeah,
she has like the tiny demon sent by her ancestors or whatever, or the spirit. It's very much that kind of thing.
Yeah. So there's like almost a female empowerment A-plot, as you say, because,
Sorry, I cannot contain my disgust for that.
Because Bean is fleeing an unwanted marriage and, you know, so it's very much, she's very much the lead and she's very much escaping oppressive structures and whatever, but it's all in this kind of like fantasy landscape,
like fairyland world. The kingdom is called Dreamland or something.
And then there's like a little moment where she says like, oh, I wish I could just live somewhere happy, and then it cuts to like elf wood or something, and it's like all these elves, which I thought was just like some like extended Itchy and Scratchy style joke, and then becomes like a full B plot. And I only watched one episode, but the first episode is like over 35 minutes long or something. It is like very long for an animated comedy. And
yeah,
I mean, it really dragged. I don't think we really needed all that backstory about like, which is basically just like Elf, but with like slightly darker jokes about like the elf world and how they're all sickly sweet all the time. And even their public elf hangings are like joyful and squeaky. That didn't work for me. I mean... a lot of this didn't work for me.
Yeah, I genuinely hated it. And I don't say that lightly, because normally in the things that we watch for Seriously, I can find something to enjoy about them. Because we tend not to watch things just to slate them, because that's not really what we do. But on paper, I thought this would be a reasonable bet, but actually like it viscerally affected me.
Wow.
With dislike, I really didn't like it. And then when I was... yeah, like I hate the sort of female empowerment thing of it. I hate
it, feels
the
very
fact that
false that, because so a lot false. Of the jokes are like a little sexist. I don't know, I'm gonna struggle to think of examples to prove my point now, but the joke of her being a woman who can fight kind of inherently seems a bit lazy to me. And like,
and I hate the fact that she is sort of like portrayed as cooler because she likes gambling and hard drinking. Like, that's so cliched. And
cool girl, gone girl, cool girl.
Yeah, it is a cool girl thing, but also like I don't know, there's, I feel there are so many cleverer deconstructions of fairy tales. Like fucking Shrek is a more interesting breakdown of like gender and patriarchal norms than this.
Shrek is canon, so, for a reason.
Exactly. Like, I don't know, the whole like kick-ass princess thing is very much been done.
Yeah, totally.
And yet somehow I felt like this show was offering it up as if like, hey, here's an amazing idea we've just thought of, which is, what if princess, but cool? I was like, no, go away. All of the elf stuff is boring.
Yeah.
And I could do without it.
Yeah. And for me, like the real strength of an episode of The Simpsons is like, I know this kind of got it more and more intense as the show went on, but you have those first 5 minutes that are like very messy in a Simpsons episode, where you can tell they've like got the original plot and then they've like worked backwards to a weird beginning. So there's all these red herrings at the beginning of a Simpsons episode where like the first 5 minutes are like totally six different directions, and then suddenly Homer arrives at work or whatever and the episode actually begins. But they were like really tightly constructed episodes, and
very much,
you know,
so
the constraints of having to be no more than 20 minutes a time, like, is part of, I think, why those shows are so good. And so, like, you know,
and having to have an ad break in the middle, I really felt that actually Netflix has not done Matt Groening any favors.
No,
I think he's someone who needs restrictions.
Yeah,
to make your stuff work.
This is very messy. And to me, I was watching it like, why would I ever want, like, I can imagine the pitch meeting for this where they're like, this is an epic sprawling fantasy like Game of Thrones, but with all the humor and like dark jokes of The Simpsons. It's like going to be perfect for that millennial, sardonic, binge watching generation of like men who want, you know, all the humor and stuff of that with all the kind of like weird epic fantasy of Game of Thrones. And I'm like, why would I want what is for a reason very traditionally like a 20-minute comedy format to have all the bizarre twists and turns of Game of Thrones? That's just something that I don't think anyone actually wants, even though you can make it sound like it's what they want. Like, it just felt like, you know, at the end there was a cliffhanger and I was like, a literal cliffhanger, you know, yeah, full cliche cliffhanger. And I felt like, I don't care what happens to these people. And like, the great thing about a lot of 20-minute animated comedies is that you end up back at the beginning, and it's like an endless,
it feels like a contained world. Yeah.
And like, obviously there are lots of amazing animated comedies that play with that trope or like break out of it completely. So I'm not trying to say that that's a fundamental flaw of Disenchantment. It just doesn't work. Like, what they've tried to achieve is just like rambly, and it's not very, like, the humor fundamentally is
it's not very funny.
And it's not cutting edge. Like, you know, it's not daring. Like, there's a difference between stuff that's like deliberately black and stuff that's edgy. And this is like tired, boring jokes that are, yes, deliberately black, but they're not edgy in any way. Like, it's not like, I don't know, it fails.
But I think it thinks it is edgy.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is, for me, just death to any kind of humour.
Totally. So like the cartoon hanging, which to me feels like very Family Guy, like very, you know, like mid-noughties in vibe. Like, just doing that now is not, that's not edgy, even if it is like quite a visually shocking or unpleasant joke. It's just like, yeah, we've done comedy like this now, and it's just kind of like boring to watch.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt about it. That, and I saw some people tweeting about the fact that like there isn't a single female director involved in any of these episodes, or indeed I think even like maybe there's a second season slated and there like isn't a single one attached for that either. I have to, I haven't like fully researched this, but I saw people saying,
I mean, it does feel like quite boys clubby, as a,
that does make sense to me, that like, and I don't know, maybe this is an interpretation too far, but I feel like the group of dudes that got super successful in the 90s with The Simpsons think they've still got it
and can now do whatever they want,
because they made The Simpsons and it was really good to start with and it did make a ton of money and it was like so culturally significant. They think now that they own animated humor and the world has moved on and they have not, and what they've made now is not good.
Yeah, it's a shame, because I do think that if it was approached in the same way that The Simpsons had been approached in the beginning, as though like, great, you've got an interesting idea, let's like with loads of rigor and discipline make this good, then it could have been great. Like, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the idea of what they're doing. It just has fallen apart.
And stuff like, you know, Archer is super popular for a reason. Like, I haven't watched a ton of it, but I do like what I've seen. It's funny and good at deconstructing like contemporary masculinity and that kind of thing. And then like BoJack Horseman has a massive following for a reason. You know, they managed to make people care about,
it has real characters,
a man with a horse's head and like struggles with mental health and all,
and they flesh them out despite them being like, all of these characters are visual jokes or like, you know, jokes in dialogue. They're not characters, they're just place-ins for whatever the punchline is that is happening next. And that's, I mean, it is the first episode, and sometimes these things do need to develop over time. But for me, I was just like, why would I keep watching this? I just couldn't think of a single reason.
It's sufficiently bad that I didn't even want to try and watch another one.
Also, I watched the first 2 minutes maybe 2 weeks ago and was like, oh, like got distracted and was like, okay, I'll come back to that in a bit. And I just so didn't want to go back to it, even only after the first 2 minutes. I was like, oh, really can't be bothered with this.
Yeah, so a rare thumbs down completely from us, I think, for Disenchantment.
Boo.
Boo indeed.
So last week we were recommended the 2010 film Beginners, which is directed by Mike Mills, who directed 20th Century Women, which is one of my favourite films, I think, of the last couple of years. So you saw it and enjoyed it too, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
It, I think, was recommended to us in part because we both have dogs and the lead character played by Ewan McGregor has a Jack Russell who doesn't so much speak but is kind of subtitled for the audience. So yeah, you've got a kind of semi-talking dog in it. And the essential premise is that Ewan McGregor's mother passes away. It's set in 2003, by the way. So it is set 7 years before it's actually released. So it's like a semi-period film. And after Ewan McGregor's mother passed away, his father, who's Christopher Plummer, embarks on life as an out gay man, which is, that's the immediate premise, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea being that, you know, he's really near the end of his life and he just wants to go like, fuck it, I shall be who I am for whatever time I have left.
Yeah, he wants to be a gay person in practice as well as in theory.
Yeah, exactly. Which is really interesting. And also the period that it's set is an interesting decision as well, like 2003 being just before the kind of mainstream acceptance in a lot of places of things like gay marriage.
Yeah, it's
and so
a very
on,
interesting, you know, period in which to set the film.
Yeah, exactly. So like, I'm pretty sure, you know, America didn't get equal marriage, did it, until President Obama started talking about it after 2008. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is the point when, like, for a lot of people, the LGBT movement has been normalized, but not in a kind of officially state recognized way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not really, it's very different to 20th century women, isn't it? It's like,
yes.
Which I...
Oh, I meant to say, apparently this is based on Mike Mills's actual real life experience.
Oh, how funny.
Like, his father did come out really late in life.
Yeah. There were parts of it that I found really charming, actually, and really enjoyed. And it's also very, like, stylish the whole way through.
Yes.
One part that I wanted to ask you your opinion on was the meeting between Ewan McGregor and his love interest.
Oh, the French woman.
Yes.
Yeah, I wasn't really into that as a relationship.
Yeah, neither was I, but I found that meeting scene very interesting. And I found their dynamic a little bit manic pixie dream girl.
Oh, that was why I said I wasn't really into that, because the fact that she's French is like most of her personality.
Yeah, it's like a kind of weird quirky thing. And they meet at a dress-up party in which it's Oliver, Ewan McGregor's
Oliver,
character.
Yeah.
Oliver is dressed as basically Sigmund Freud. I can't even remember what she's dressed as, but like a sort of Victorian-y vibe.
Something cutesy, ruffled.
Yeah, yeah, I can't remember. And she lies down on his couch to be analysed, but she's got laryngitis, so she doesn't speak. And their whole meeting is based around this quirky idea where the woman is like literally silenced.
Yes.
And I just found that like,
and in
so...
a vulnerable position, like,
yeah.
As, yeah.
And it's like a joke, it's all a big joke, which is why it's so manic pixie dream girl. And she's like writing on her pad and stuff, and then they have a dance where she's like kind of signaling with her hands instead of speaking. But his like immediate attraction to her in that context just seems so funny to me. So it's like there are like parts to the film where I was like, okay, I'm not like all in on this, but
the bit I did find really charming was Christopher Plummer's character.
Yeah.
I think he is amazing in this film.
Like, it was a great performance.
So
was
good.
It not an Oscar-winning performance?
I'm not actually sure. It definitely was a very highly praised one. I think no, he did. He won. Yeah. He won Best Supporting Actor for it.
Yeah. So
why is it Best Supporting Actor? I think he's the star.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean,
this is my routine.
It's
like,
always
anger
it's
with
always
the way
so,
Hollywood categorizes.
So subjective, isn't it? And it's just, I think it just depends on what they put you forward for. Like, essentially.
No, it's not. I remember reading up on this, and you remember that film with Dev Patel called Lion?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's relative minutes on screen.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So Dev Patel was only nominated for Best Supporting Actor for that film, despite being...
The main character.
The main character, because the child version of him had
so
relatively
much
so much screen time.
Right.
So actually neither of them qualified for Best Actor.
Right.
Because
well, there's your answer then, I guess.
It's something like, I think you have to have like the majority of the screen time or something. Who the hell sits there with like a stopwatch and measures these things? I do not know.
Well, that's the kind of thing that I would get like quite sick pleasure out of, actually. But yes. Yeah.
It's a stupid rule. And I think Christopher Plummer was cheated by it.
But he would never have, I just don't think he would have won in the, I actually don't know what the performances were in that year. But would he have won in a best actor? This was not, I feel like, a significant enough release at the time.
Probably not, no.
Everyone to have awarded it that. Not, though I guess that's not the point. It shouldn't be about how big the movie is.
But it is though, isn't it? That is how, yeah, how things work. But yeah, overall, I'm glad to have watched this. I'm not sure I would have seen it otherwise if we hadn't been recommended.
No.
Because
it's kind of a film I've been weirdly curious about as well for a while, because I do see the posters. I don't know why. Like, I feel like when I'm Googling like tropes, it comes up. It's probably not a great thing, but yeah.
I would like, I don't know if this is a trope, but I would like it to be a trope. Sort, yeah, of like older person coming out film. Is that a trope?
I feel like there's definitely another one, and now I like can't remember.
I would like Nancy Myers to make one. If she hasn't already.
Yeah, she not can, already. That can she like make a,
can she make
premise.
A Diane Keaton comes out late in life film?
Yeah, yes.
I would be so here for that. That would be brilliant.
Yeah.
So, Anna, you've got an idea about what we're going to do next time.
Yeah, this is just because I know that I couldn't justify doing this as a main section on Seriously, but I have not seen this, but a lot of people I know have sort of been tweeting about it. And I've just been on holiday with my friend who's obsessed with this particular program. And I was like, will you watch that with me? And she was like, no, I'm saving it for the plane. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. So it's basically Celebrity MasterChef featuring Gemma Collins, which is just something I want to see really badly.
So for people who don't know, who's Gemma Collins?
Gemma Collins is a reality TV star who was on The Only Way is Essex.
Or Towie.
AKA Towie. And she's extremely funny, extremely confident, quite abrasive, voluptuous blonde woman who, I think she became famous really in Towie for the scene where she's been rejected by someone who's then been like spreading lies about her, and she like gets up on the top of a swimming pool and like opens her kind of robe and reveals her swimming costume and says, you ain't ever gonna get this candy. Take a good look. And she's almost famous in the UK for she is famous in the UK, but she's like got a kind of cult status because of so many different things, like the time she wore like a really hideous like shoulder padded orange dress.
Oh, yes.
The fact that she does all these videos on her Instagrams that start, hi girls. The fact that she went on Celebrity Big Brother and was just absolutely mental, and the fact that she calls memes memes.
Yes, that's the part that I find most ridiculous about her, because I'm pretty sure she definitely does it on purpose.
Yeah, I think at first she definitely didn't, but because it like came from this video where she was like, hi girls, just want to say thanks everyone for all the memes, thanks for this. And like everyone was like, that's hilarious. But yeah, so she's, I think, and she also recently released a book and then like had to do an interview with someone who hadn't read the book because they hadn't been given a copy of the book. And it was just like the most excruciating and hilarious interview where Gemma Collins is like, I don't really want to talk about this if you haven't read the book. And the PR is like having a meltdown. And she's like, you say in your book, blah. And she's like, do I? I don't remember that bit. It's like visibly a ghostwritten book.
It's an absolutely incredible interview. Like, I saw so many people tweeting about it, and I really wanted someone, maybe they did and I just didn't see it, but someone to write a really insightful essay being like, this Gemma Collins interview exposes the reality of publishing today.
Yeah, totally.
Because it absolutely did. Like, she had not even read her own book, really.
Yeah.
It was clearly like ghostwritten or something.
And yet the PRs had obviously been so nervous about it that they hadn't actually sent it out to the people who needed to receive a copy.
Yeah, because I've been going through a tiny bit of this myself, because I've reviewed this new memoir by Steve Jobs' daughter, which is actually already published. Like, you can walk into a shop and buy it, but the publishers have embargoed it for 2 weeks after its publication date. So my review is only running this weekend.
Is it really bad?
Well, it's not even really bad. It's just really boring. And
how bizarre.
I think,
so they want people to think there's a salacious secret in there that they can't read in a review.
Isn't really. But the stupid thing is that there wasn't such an embargo in America. So like the New York Times has run like an entire extract of it, a huge interview with the author, which contains all of the like three facts about Steve Jobs that you didn't know before you read this book. And because the internet exists, you can literally find these things out with like a 2 second Google.
That's so funny.
It was so bizarre. Like, I had to sign this massive contract, and so did the newspaper and stuff, to say that they wouldn't publish my review early or anything like that. And so I was like all hyped for this big tell-all book, and then there's nothing in it.
You are right though that Gemma Collins interviews reveals so much. It reveals the three prongs of the problem, right? Which is like celebrities are given undue platform and allowed to like not write books and not even read the books that they write for money because it's a money-making machine. Mm-hmm. The problem in the PR cycle where they're like trying to fudge the actual quality of the thing from getting out to the public because their whole point is to like try like and get people to buy
the public into buying it without knowing what they're buying.
Yeah, and not giving the journalist the information that she needs to actually conduct a proper interview because they don't want a proper interview, they want a PR stunt. And three, the magazine that was willing to send a journalist to do an interview about a book
under
that
those
journalist hasn't read. And like, I don't know, it's just like three in separate industries that are all dying in their own weird way, like just colliding. I did find that fascinating, but yet again we have rambled off the
we have indeed. So the point is, we're going to watch Gemma Collins on Celebrity MasterChef and we will report back next week.
Normally we're so tight, but this week we've just been like absolutely all over the place, sorry.
Yes,
but I'm really excited for Celebrity MasterChef, so can't
I love MasterChef. I've loved it since I was a small child and Loy Grossman was presenting it. And I've just, so as you say, like, because we've essentially made watching TV our job, I therefore cannot justify watching MasterChef all year round when I'm not writing about it or anything.
I'm gonna do it with a big bowl of pasta. That's what I'm gonna
do. You have to eat pasta while you're watching MasterChef. It is the law.
It's the rule. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.